nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology.
We were trying to figure out ways of fixing problems that other people have created for you by giving you discontinuous models. So, you know, what can we do about it? So there are basically the idea is to identify any discontinuous function such as this one. This is almost like a, you know, it's like a canonical discontinuity. It's like a step function. And replace it by something that, of course, cannot be identical, otherwise it would be discontinuous, but is approximately the same and captures essentially the idea of this discontinuity, that it moves, things move very fast, but smoothly. So, and as we saw, we were just running these examples, depending on, so if you approximate this using a tan h, this step using a tan h k times x, if you keep increasing k, it, you can make it sharper and sharper, right? So, that was k is 100. You can make it 1,000, I guess. Okay, so when it's 1,000, you can hardly see the difference, at least using the eyeball. A fact that is sometimes referred to as the eyeball metric, because your eye can only see up to approximately 2 decimal places, right? So if you take the, you know, the entire field of vision to be like a scale of 0 to 1. Then you can resolve about only 2 decimal places. 2 decimal places in this business is not much. Okay, it's pretty poor. So that is why some people can get their papers accepted in journals by drawing a few diagrams. But if you do a more serious analysis of it, then you'll find that the errors are actually huge. 2 decimal places is pretty bad. Right? So, but you see that with 1,000, you know, at least using the eyeball metric. Let me try to expand it a little bit over here. You can see that it sort of matches out here. I could have taken a few more points. I've taken only 1,000 here, but you can see it's coming around. If I take 10,000 or 100,000 points, you'll see that this red line over here looks actually pretty smooth because it's a tan h, right? And that's essentially what it's going to be. So the question is, what k do you choose for a given situation? And that really is very, very situation dependent. Okay. So, given that, so suppose so by the way, tan h is just an example. You can use any other kind of function that sort of fits the bill, that it basically looks like, 0 or minus 1 on the left side, 1 or plus 1, 1 on the right side, and sort of moves smoothly up between 0 and 1, close enough to the place where the discontinuity jumps up. Okay. So, I'm just going to be using tan h because it just happens to be a convenient thing at hand. When you look at any kind of device code, particularly something like BSIM or something of that complexity, you will find that people quite naturally end up using a lot of discontinuous functions inside, and worse. We'll talk about the worse in a second. So here are some common things to watch out for. Sine. People will use sine, right? People will use even step functions. That is a little bit less common. Sine is very common, right? People will use absolute value. This is really very common inside device models. All of these things are, of course, discontinuous one way or the other. Either they're discontinuous or their first derivatives are, abs looks like this. So it's not great. Clip is less common, but basically what clip is this function. That's 0 over there. That's x. This is clip of x, and that looks like this. 0 here, and it goes up like that. So it's basically, it just clips it to 0 when the argument becomes negative. Otherwise, it just replicates the argument. So this is just x. So then, of course, as I mentioned earlier, if then and else conditions, right? In code, you'll typically find if then else of this generic form. X is your variable, it might be a voltage or something like that. If X is greater than some number A, frequently 0 or some other constant like VTH or something like that, then if it is greater than A, then Y should be some expression F1 of X, If it is other, not greater than A, if it's less than or equal to A, then why it should be some other expression, F2 of X. So you've already seen that before. Okay, and you can of course have nested if conditions. We have seen that too in the Shikman-Hodges model. So this is the kind of stuff that you will see, and you will potentially need to fix in your models. So here's a recipe. This is only a recipe, so take it with a grain of salt, because after you apply it, you should plot your so-called smooth function. Sometimes you will find that your so-called smooth function, although it is smooth using this recipe, is actually worse than the non-smooth function in some important respects. I'll tell you a little bit more about what could be worse in a second. But it's very important to, in your specific case, you know, check the final thing that you got by plotting it if you can, or by other means if you can't plot it so easily. So firstly, the sine function, which is basically what I was plotting in MATLAB right now, you can replace that by tan h k times x. Okay, where you choose k to be your favorite number, which seems to fit the bill, right? And you can call that smooth sine, and it's a function of x, but it also has a parameter. The parameter is k, right? Once you've defined sine of x, step of x is simply 1 plus sine of x, right? But divided by 2. So you can just replace this sine by smooth sine, and then you get smooth step of a of x. Then there's clip of x. So step of x is basically, if you plot it on this plot here, step is 0 here and 1 here. If you integrate that starting from lower limit 0, and on the right side you will obviously get x, on the left side you'll get 0, right? And that is clip of x, right? So that's this. So if you now replace this step over here with smooth step, right, then you get a clip of x. Anyone have any problem with this last one, especially? Could there be an issue with it?
Is it not a continuous function?
What is not a continuous function?
Step of y.
Step of x. Or clip, step of y. Step of y is not a continuous, well, neither is clip, step of y is certainly not a continuous function. And clip of x is not a derivable function. This is the integral. So essentially, clip of x looks like this, like the blue line out here. And over here, there's no derivative at 0. Step of x, of course, looks like that gray line over here. And over here, it's even discontinuous. Forget about the derivative. So but what we are doing is we are replacing this step of x by this tan h inspired approximation. Okay, like that. Yes.
What if you really need it to be 0 then?
Very good point. That's part of the that's why I call it a recipe and not a science. If you really need it to be 0 at exactly 0, you have a few issues. Let me talk about one of those issues. What happens then is that you might have to bring this negative and take it through 0. Bringing it negative when it really should be 0 on the left side might be worse, depending on your situation, than you're avoiding getting it to be exactly 0 at 0. Right? So this is exactly the sort of thing that you need to deal with. So, for example, one place where you might not really want to avoid making it negative is if a diode is involved somehow. If you make it negative, then, and you know, this function that you're smoothing represents a current that goes through the diode, right? If it's minus one, if it's negative 1e minus 11 and the diode's IS is 1e minus 12, then the circuit won't solve, because the diode is simply incapable of taking in anything less than, you know, less than negative 1e minus 12. So these, you know, these qualitative things that you want to watch out for them. So here, for example, along the lines of your question, this is abs of x, right? Perfect abs of x. If you want to smooth it, there are several things. You know, there are two immediate things that might occur to you. One of them is to sort of go like this, and I'm exaggerating it, and then do that, right? So at zero, it's no longer zero. Another, if you really want to keep it zero over there, might be to bring it down over here and do something like that. Turns out then it'll have to have an inflection point. Okay. And if it has an inflection point, that can be worse than you're missing the zero. You're missing the zero out here. So yeah, that's why these things can be a little delicate. So you know, when you do something, check it out, see whether it seems reasonable physically for the particular application that you're using, and then you know, make a decision. But clip of x has another problem. So what I'm doing is I'm taking sine of x replacing by smooth sine. I'm taking step of x and replacing by smooth step. So I replace this by smooth step over here to get smooth clip of x, right? So this is an integral. How am I going to evaluate? Suppose you have to write a MATLAB routine for smooth clip of x. How will you evaluate it? Are you going to numerically integrate? It seems like a lot of, firstly, that anytime you do anything numerically, integration, something like that, it starts making the thing approximate. Okay, so you can't get away from that too much. So if you're setting up these recipes, then it's a really good idea if this thing has an analytical expression. Okay, so that's one of the reasons I chose tan h, because this thing does have an analytical expression. Does anyone remember, or can you guess offhand? I'd be very impressed if you can. What the integral of tan h is?
Minus x.
Sorry?
Integral of
tan. Integral of tan. Not differential coefficient of tan h. Because that's basically what you'll have to integrate. You know, it'll be 0.51 plus tan h k times x thrown in over here. Well, I had to look it up myself, and I keep forgetting it every semester. So it turns out that the integral of tan h y dy is, let me see if I remember this, log, natural log of 2 cosine hyperbolic x. So there is an analytical expression for it, which is great, because then you can just stick that in over here for your smooth clip. Okay. If there isn't an analytical expression, then you know, you probably need to think of changing your recipe a little bit. And abs of x is basically clip of x, which goes up like this and flat over here, and clip of minus x, which is the flip of it. Just add them together. Another way you can do it is you can double clip of x. You can make the slope twice, and then you can subtract x from it. Right. So there are two different ways of doing it. So basically, you know, as far as these are concerned, which are pretty much mostly what you'll see in terms of discontinuous functions, you have at least a recipe. How well it works, you know, especially in light of the questions you asked, you know, remains to be seen. It depends on what kind of situation you are in. In fact, this homework that I'm going to assign tonight has a smoothing problem, right? And when you smooth it, you'll find that if you do the job right, that is, you'll find that the smooth version is actually in many respects considerably worse than the non-smooth version, right? It just doesn't capture the qualitative features of it all that well, right? So it's a tricky game, but it's a game worth knowing. All right, so how about a generic formula or a procedure for replacing this if condition thing, okay? So here's a generic way of writing, you know, like an if condition. If there is some condition of x on x is greater than 0, so condition of x might be x minus a, that's very common. Okay, if x minus a is greater than 0, or anything else, right, some other, you know, usually a smooth condition, this function condition itself is smooth, okay, is greater than 0, then y is equal to some f1, otherwise y is equal to f2. So in order to see how to do this, you know, in a generic way, it's quite helpful to write this if condition in a different way. It's exactly equivalent, except computationally, in terms of computational effort, that is, but in terms of the result, it's exactly equivalent. So I have broader. If condition of x is greater than 0, then y equals f1 of x, else y equals f2 of x, right? I can write this. So condition of x is a function, right? That will give me, let's say, either one. So condition of x greater than 0. This is something that will give me either 1 or 0, right? So I can write this as same thing. I can write this as y equals condition of x greater than 0. If it's true, then this is 1 times f1 of x plus 1 minus condition of x greater than 0 times f2 of x. So basically, if this is true, then this is going to be 1, you get f of x. If that is true, then this 1 minus 1 will be 0 and f2 of x will go away. If on the other hand this is not true, then this will be 0 and no, there will be no component of f1 of x. If it is not true, this is 0, this is 1 minus 0, that's 1, f2 of x comes out, right? Once you can write it like this, right, then all you have to do is you have to smooth this, because that is the only thing you need to smooth, right?
Oh, the convex, you don't need to smooth that one?
Sorry?
On the first part.
Well, I mean, you can, so basically, you can just, for example, to understand how, so, quant x might be equivalent to x minus a, right? This is the most typical thing, that there is a threshold, you know, it might be some, you know, say, x squared minus a, or, you know, some function of x minus, of x minus some constant, but basically it's typically like that, right? And you're basically smoothing x minus a is greater than 0, right? Which, if you look at the picture, this is x, right? This is some threshold a, and x minus a greater than 0 is quite simply 0 out here, and 1 out there. Right, that's what it is. Put a smooth step around this, and it becomes smooth. And then just stick it into that, and you have a if condition smooth.
What about if you have like three choices?
Well, yeah, excellent. And I won't answer that question because it's part of the homework. You just, the answer is, you just apply this one more time, but the caveat to that answer is that be real careful. It's possible to mess up like crazy, and I wouldn't mind if you actually, during your homework, you actually did mess up, because that's the best way to know that you can mess up. So just check it, you know, draw the plots and so on. You'll find that if you just do it quickly, you know, without thinking too much about it, probably you'll get it wrong. If you think just a little bit about it, you'll get it right. Okay. So basically, here is some pseudo code. It's actually not even pseudo. It is MATLAB code. But yeah, so you just smooth step it. Put smooth step around condition x with some smoothing parameter k. Call that to be yes, no. If you didn't put the smooth step, this would be either 0 or 1. Okay, if you do with the smooth step, it will be, you know, something between 0 and 1. And then you just put that over here, that's the if condition thing. And you're done. Okay. Alright, so that, you know, that was the easy part. What is worse, in some sense, than some of these discontinuous things, which you can have a handle on if you can find them, is other kinds of functions that are very, very commonly used by physicists, especially, mainly because the way in which physicists get these expressions is via some process of idealization, right? So you typically, if you want to do anything analytical, there is some idealization going on somewhere, with maybe with some rare exceptions, which but mostly it's like that. So when you come up with an analytical expression for some semiconductor related situation, you will find, you know, things like square roots, logs, and so on crawling all over the place. The problem with functions like square root, for example, is that it's not defined if you want to stay within the realm of real numbers for the answer, it's not defined for negative numbers, right? And for reasons that will become clear later on, shortly, you can't rely that any voltage that the device gets is going to be in, you know, for example, avoid negative numbers. You just can't. Even if the solution of the circuit makes that unphysical to have a negative number, in the process of getting that solution, there are numerical techniques that have, you know, don't care anything about physicality. They will change that number to whatever it wants, the Newton-Raphson algorithm in particular. And so you will get negative numbers inside that square root, and the moment that happens, your entire simulation will barf because you have a square root inside it. So, you know, even if it physically makes perfect sense to have a square root in there, because you never expect to get a real situation where x is negative, this is not a real situation, this is simulation. There are algorithms involved. Okay, they don't care about whether it's real or not. It will become negative, you can count on it. Okay, so basically what you need to do there is you need to ensure that you change the square root to something else that basically maintains the main idea of the square root, but still evaluate to something, you know, reasonable when x is negative. So try smooth clip of x comma k, right? Smooth clip, let me remind you, was that blue line. It's zero when it's negative, and it's the same thing as x when it's positive. Okay, and it's smooth in the middle. So you can do that, right? So why not just clip without the smooth part? Would it be discontinuous? So let me draw. The square root function is an interesting one, because it becomes clear when you draw it. It's not defined for negative numbers, okay? The strict square root function, unless you go into the complex domain, which we are not going into. So this is square root of x. What does it look like? Does it look like this? Doesn't look like that. Square looks like that. Cube looks like that. Square root looks like this. Okay? Which means that right at zero, basically it becomes very, very steep. In fact, it becomes infinitely steep. So square root at zero, although square root of zero is perfectly well defined, the derivative, even the right side derivative, right, is not defined. It's infinity basically, right? This is a problem. Because you really want to avoid derivatives like infinity, where they're essentially not defined. Hence, if you put clip, it would be all right. Basically, you know, it would the derivative on the left side would be exactly zero, and the derivative on the right side would be exactly infinity, right at zero. That is not good. That's why smooth clip. Yes.
Wouldn't the log of zero also
bar smooth clip? Of course. Yeah. Well, when we haven't talked about log yet, right? Because the smooth clip that I am talking about, because it's a smooth function, it never actually goes to zero. It goes very close to zero, as close as you like by adjusting these parameters and so on, but it never actually goes to zero. And that's why smooth clip, by the way, you can not go to zero in two ways. You can be above zero or you can be below zero. Just make sure it doesn't go below zero, because then even this will buff. So smooth clip really should look something like, see if I can exaggerate this a little bit. Well, so a real clip in absolute perfection looks like this. Your smooth clip should probably, you know, I'm exaggerating it, but it should probably look something like that. It should not look like that. these are the little, things. It's kind of obvious, but you'd be surprised if you don't actually explicitly think about it and, and keep it in mind how easy it is to fall into these traps. The only time when you'll find out is when you're running a simulation, when there's 100 other things going on top of this. And it's very hard to find out what actually is breaking, unless you know what you're doing. Okay, so that was log. Right. 1 over x, or typically 1 over x minus a or something like that. You find it crawling all over the place in all kinds of codes. 1 over x is a hard one. Because, with log and square root, one entire side is on the left side, is basically illegal, so you can put smooth clip around it to deal with that. But 1 over x, the left side is not illegal. At least, usually. So, let's say I make this 1 over x minus a, and this point over here is a. This looks like, here it's less than a, so this kind of looks like, and it looks like that over here, and it looks like that. So not only is it not defined at x equals a, if you look at just a little bit to the left of it and then look at just a little bit to the right of it, there is a 2 times infinity, if that makes any sense, jump between the two. Okay. Now if you call this physical, then you probably don't know what physical means, right? So it's really, if you're using an equation like this and you actually expect it to be somewhat valid over this region around A, there is some big mistake you have made. Right. So if you're using an equation like this, then the best excuse for you is that you don't expect x to come anywhere near A. Right? It's not valid. So in which case you can do, you can find some way of using smoothing functions to sort of do something like that, maybe, and sort of come around over here. It depends on what your original intent is. The only thing that is more or less clear is that your original intent couldn't have been that x approaches a. Right? How much, what these distances are and so on is open to question, depends on the situation. So pretty much many semiconductor codes have exactly these things, which is why if you're in the situation of having to write your own model or something, or pick up somebody's model and put it in your simulator or something like that, you should know that these are the pitfalls. These are the beginning pitfalls. There are many more. The whole thing is all about pitfalls. So so that's what you have over here. Any questions about these these domain problems? We looked at smoothness problems, discontinuity problems, then we looked at domain problems. Now I'm going to tell you about overflow problems. Okay. I think I've already mentioned in an earlier class that using the diode example where there was an exponential, that if you put like 20 volts in a diode, then you get a number that is so big that the double precision system or something like that can't handle it. Right? They're pretty big. Well, at least you lose a lot of precisions. But let me say that when you're doing anything on a computer, as opposed to theoretically with real numbers, in a computer, real numbers can't be of any value you want. Sometimes we don't use very large numbers in real life, so we forget this fact or never even know it. So let me give you a demo over here. All right. So exponent of, actually I have the numbers written over here, so there's no need to, exponent of 709, right, let me make it exponent of 700, let's say, format long e, exponent of 700 is that number. As I had already mentioned earlier, double precision in computers, basically I think it uses, it uses 8 bytes, so 64 bits, right? And if you use 64 bits, the total number of digits that you can actually keep track of is about 16. So you see those digits over here. That's basically all the computer has. And then there's plus 3 or 4, which basically means that you can, add another 300 or so zeros at the end of it. It's a big number. And all the rest of them, you don't know what those numbers are because the computer isn't capable of keeping them, right? So, so now I do exponent of 707, 307, find 708, 709. Wait a moment, have I got this wrong? 709 works, but 710, it is so large that the double precision format, so the double precision format, without getting into the nitty-gritty details of it, it keeps something like 8 bytes for the actual digits, and it keeps another some number of bytes, I think it's 2 bytes or something like that, or some number of bits, to keep the exponent. If your number is so large that even your exponent doesn't fit in those 2 bytes, then basically it declares it to be infinity. More precisely, MATLAB declares it to be infinity. The double precision standard declares it to be a floating point overflow error. Okay, and this will come out, you know, on a computer, the chip that actually, the part of a chip that does the computation, has a special wire which is called an exception wire, and that exception wire gets asserted, and it will eventually, you can, if you have enough programming stuff around it, you can detect it. So that's what shows up as an IEEE floating point error. And if you write C code, for example, or code in any reasonable language, and you do a computation, you can then go and check to see whether there's been a floating point error. And one of the kinds of floating point error is this overflow error. There are others too. Okay, so basically, if you have about 20 volts over here inside a diode, then you've got an IEEE floating point error. 20 volts is not a hard voltage, as I mentioned earlier, for a simulator or a circuit to actually have. It's just a stupid thing if you connect it across a diode, but in a simulator, you know, it can happen. So what do you want? You want to, of course, avoid these errors, because the moment you have an error, none of your algorithms can actually do anything, right? It just comes back and says there's a floating point error, end. That's it. So so you have to do something called trapping the error. So your code, you know, your model code should actually either change your model so that there is no way you can get such large numbers, right? Or you have to throw in some extra stuff that actually detects if there's an error and comes back and says to you, there is an error, the model is not valid, cancel your simulation, go do something else. The first is preferable to the second one, because if you just, usually these numbers are so large that it doesn't, the solution of the circuit shouldn't approach those numbers. So you can change the numbers to be something smaller, so long as you don't hit the errors. So that's what you do. So that's an extreme case when you run into overflow errors. But really sneaky things can happen even without running into overflow errors. So for example, take a look at, let's take a look at this expression. I choose some x, I take exponent of x, I add x to it, then I subtract exponent of x again from this, right? In reality, this is simply x, right? Let's see what happens if I actually do it out here. X equals something, let's say 1, exponent of x plus x, and we put parentheses around it to make sure that computation is done first, and then subtract exponent of x, right? X equals 1. Great. The answer is 1. Should be. X equals 10. The answer is 10. Good. X equals 20. The answer is 20. Amazing. So, X equals 30. Oh my god. Windows never sees. So, okay. Let's see. X equals 35. 36. 30. You can see I've done this before. See, x equals 37, answer is 36. Right? X equals 38, answer is 36 too. Okay. X equals 100, not a very large number, answer is 0. How do you explain this? Yeah. So let's let's take x equals 100, right? Exponent of x is that number, right? As I said, approximately 16 decimal digits, right? So I take this number. Mind you, that exponent plus 43 means that there is like another like 30 odd zeros to the right of it. Take that number and I add, what was x? 100. What do I get? Precisely the same number. Because it just doesn't have the space to keep that amount of resolution. That's what is happening because of double precision. Right? And then you subtract these two things, you get zero. Around 35 or 36, it gets a little bit more interesting. Because just about running out of the number of digits. 35, it's that. Okay. Then I take that and I add 35 to it. Right, you do see that the last few digits change a little bit. Right? And apparently it's just about enough around 35. So if I then take this and I subtract 35 from it, subtract this amount from it, I get back 35, I think. Right? But if I do this with 36, I lose like one digit or some part of a digit or something like that. It's all being done in binary, mind you. So that's why if you really want to get the dynamic exactly right, do it in binary. Sooner you than me. Anyway, so that's basically what's going on. So the cardinal rule here is to remember, don't take a large number and a small number and add them if you can avoid it. Sometimes you cannot, but try not to. Definitely try to look for ways of not doing that. And certainly, don't subtract two large numbers from each other and expect to get a decent result. Right? If you can rearrange your equations, even at considerable trouble, to write it in some other way so that this, you don't have to actually compute a large number and then subtract it again from another large number. That is good. Quite often you can do it. There are times when you cannot avoid it, in which case, basically your modeling isn't going to be that great. Yeah.
Can we kind of relation is made up number?
Sorry? But
for example, if we are going to give the very large number,
yeah,
we divide that number by a factor and then end up that and work with it. For example, say that we are going to work with 10 to the power 35.
Yes.
Then we divide the factor 10 to the power 30 and divide everything.
Yeah. It's a good thought, and it's actually used in large systems of equations. The technique is called scaling. Okay, but it doesn't always work. It basically depends on what you scale and what the equation system is, right? So it's not a completely bulletproof means of doing anything. There is no completely bulletproof means of doing anything over here. Okay, but yeah, we'll talk about it later when we come to circuit equation formulations, and especially when we get to matrices. Okay, it's a good idea to scale your variables and your equations in such a way that the actual numerical values of the numbers that are expected are roughly similar. Okay. It is a really bad idea to scale your variables in such a way that one of them should have a range like 10 to the power of 50, okay, and the other one has a range like 0.1. Okay, that will kill your simulation then and there because of exactly this kind of problem. So, okay. So, by the way, exponentials happen to be very common, not only in semiconductors, but also in biology, for example. There's something called a Nernst equation, which actually involves exponentials. Surprisingly similar to the diode, okay, for biology and chemistry and so on. So it's a good idea to have some kind of recipe for exponentials. So there is a time-tested and by now almost standardized approximation that people use for exponentials, which also has this pretty much almost standardized name. It's called LIM exponential. As the name might suggest, it's a limited exponential. What does that mean? This is what it means. Very simple concept, also simple to implement. Most circuit simulators that allow you to write device models and put them in will force you to use LIM exponential instead of exponential. Well, and if you don't, then you know they will complain and stuff like that. So exponential, basically, let me try to draw it. The exponential looks kind of like. Then it goes up very fast. Maybe I should exaggerate this a little bit. This point here is 1, because this is 0. The limited exponential does the following. It takes some value over here, some pretty large value by the standards of the exponential. This point over here is 10 to the power of 20, 30, something like that, the value over here. So this might be around maybe 10, 20 or something like that. 20 is not a bad number, 15 is not a bad number, okay? And then after this point, instead of keeping on going up at the rate of the exponential, it just puts a straight line. Before that, it's the exact exponential. After that, it's a straight line. The slope of the straight line exactly matches the slope over here. Okay? So it becomes a poor man's smooth. It's continuous, and its first derivative is also continuous. Second derivative is not. So it becomes poor man's smooth, and this makes an incredible difference. Right? If you take, you know, x to be 100 out here, actually what was it? 309 or 310 or something like that. Exponent went off to infinity, right? If you do this, you'll find that you can take x to, you know, 10 to the power of 50 or something like that before. Basically, you can take x to 10 to the power of 300 or so before it, you get an overflow. So it just completely widens the range of x, and you get some reasonable values. This approximation holds provided, of course, your real exponential, at least when the circuit is finally solved, will never have an argument of greater than 20. Right? And that number 20 is not hard and fast. You choose it based on the situation. You just make sure that number is above a point where you ever expect any reasonable solution to be. And this makes a critical difference in the robustness of your numerical methods. Okay. People also, you know, I don't know whether it's worth it or not. Instead of making it a linear straight line, you can make it a quadratic. Then you can actually fit not only the slope, you can fit the second derivative too. Of what use that is, I have no idea, because I don't think it's so much use. So linear does just fine. But that's how it is. So that's limexp. Right. Yes?
If you never expect an argument that high, why do you need to?
Very good question. Because I said never expect an argument that high at the solution of your system. But in the process of reaching that solution of the system is going to be a nonlinear system of equations. You're going to be solving it using this method called Newton-Raphson. Newton-Raphson is a very uncontrollable beast. Right? The solution of the system might be something, a very staid number, like, you know, 0.6 volts or something like that. Right? Nowhere near like 20 or whatever it is that it takes for it to blow up. But in the process of finding that solution, the Newton-Raphson algorithm, which we'll talk about shortly, goes through a sequence of guesses. We will see that it is very easy for one of that sequence of guesses to be something like 500, you know, 10 million, something like that. It's not a solution. But when it has a guess, it will send that inside the exponential, and then everything will break and stop. If you do this, it will send the same thing inside, and it won't break. It will go on, it will recover, and it will come back to 0.6. As far as you're concerned, things are good. That's basically a good question. That's basically why you want to do this. So it is very common for people who sort of look upon simulators and modeling and systems in general as kind of an oracle where you describe the system and it gives you a physical answer. It's very common for people to have the mindset that, well, if that is the case, then I don't really need to make my models any more accurate than they need to be in the region where the arguments are physical. But the fact is that any simulation system, before it can get you a physical answer, goes through lots of unphysical things. Just purely, you know, purely numerical, mathematical things. And so, and you can very easily break those if you aren't aware of it.
Is there a method which might convert slower than Euler Raphson but is more reliable than
it's a very good question. The answer is, generically speaking, no. So the reason why you use Newton-Raphson in spite of its considerable problems, right, is that it is completely generic. You give me any system of equations and Newton-Raphson can be applied, number one. Okay, in the, you know, say any large dimensional system of equations, it can be applied. Number two, you can prove something about Newton-Raphson that says that if somehow one of your guesses comes close enough to the solution, Newton-Raphson is guaranteed to converge. However, close enough is a loose thing. Okay. And whether it comes close enough is much looser. Okay. So you can't prove anything there. So generically speaking, there's nothing better than Newton-Raphson. However, if you have, for example, certain specific kinds of systems, for example, if you have a one-dimensional system, then you can come up with guaranteed ways of solving it. Okay. Pretty much guaranteed ways of solving it. If you have certain specific kinds of systems, you know, not completely arbitrary f of x, but certain specific kind of systems, like systems of polynomials, just polynomials, you know, no tan h, no exponentials, no nothing, then you can also find ways of solving it. Yeah, guaranteed. But if you can't sort of say anything about the system, then Newton-Raphson is your best bet. There's something slightly better than that, but it uses Newton-Raphson as an internal loop several times. That's called numerical continuation of homotopy, and I'll teach it next semester in the follow-on course. That is quite a remarkable method, but it relies on Newton-Raphson. Any other questions? So I could talk a lot about, you know, other techniques like the quad method and this and that and the other. But frankly, you know, you will never use it except in very rare cases. Right? Better to learn how to get Newton-Raphson to work right, which is what we're going to be spending some time on. So other you know, so exponentials of course bad, but you know, there are other functions that are also bad. So you know the factorial function, right? N factorial, n times n minus 1. This is an integer function, like it's a discrete function because n has to be an integer, not a real number. But there's a generalization of it where you can take n to be a real number. It's called the gamma function. It grows as fast as the factorial function. Then the factorial function grows faster than the exponential. In fact, there's a whole little field of study where you look at how fast functions can grow, and so on. There's anyone heard of the Ackermann function? Okay, well, look it up. The Ackermann function. It's worth knowing about. Ackermann. It's completely irrelevant to this class, but it's something you should know. General knowledge, you know. Because it's this incredibly fast-growing function. And the fact that you can even define it is kind of amazing. Still, I have never seen an Ackermann function enter any simulation context, so that's fine. Actually, even gamma functions are pretty rare. But I do know one case where there's a gamma function. But exponentials all over the place.